Good morning. So last time we talked a bit about instruction sets. We first talked about the difference between an instruction set, the interface we have to the hardware, versus the microarchitecture, which is a particular implementation of that. And as we'll see for the rest of the semester, there are several ways of implementing a particular instruction set. Instruction set might be designed with one of those in mind, but that doesn't tie you to a particular implementation strategy. We talked about something in instruction set design where we have these two broad categories based on some big historical examples. We have this RISC philosophy where the instruction set is designed to make the hardware simpler with the notion that, yeah, that's going to mean our compilers are doing more work, but that's okay, versus the more CISC-like philosophy, which is designed more with having convenient things in the assembly language as what we're designing our hardware to do, and we'll figure out how to build the hardware to do that, even though that makes our hardware more complicated, but hopefully, you know, we can make our hardware more useful for the applications we're targeting is why you would do that. And we mentioned that this wasn't like a hard line. We aren't going to say that this is a RISC ISA and this is a CISC ISA with a very, very small set of exceptions. That usually things, you know, have some of one philosophy, some of the other, something like that. And we looked at the ISA we'll be using for some assignments for the rest of the semester, which is a subset of x86 called y86. This is what our textbook has chosen. And unlike x86, well, it's much smaller. We run x86 has thousands of instructions. y86 has enough that we can fit them on one slide. And it also has a much simpler encoding, which is where we left off last time. So before I move on, any questions on these topics from last time? Okay, so when I left off last time, we were talking about instruction formats. And I mentioned we have this layout here. This is the sort of chart you see in the textbook. Each of these columns here represents one hex nibble. So these two columns together are the first byte. And then we have our second byte. And we have these fill in the blanks. So for some instructions, like halt or not, there's only one possibility. For others, we have fill in the blanks, such as for less than equal or just the unconditional version for both CMove and jump, and for which of the arithmetic operators we're doing, add, subtract, XOR, and so on. And we have these tables. You can look up the tables. We're not gonna have you memorize them to determine which is which. And similarly, we have fill in the blanks for our registers. We just have a table, and to make the hardware implementation more convenient, our textbook authors chose to not have a register 15, but use 15 to represent this instruction, which takes registers, doesn't take that a register in that slot. And we have constants, like the constants we use for move instructions, either part of an address or a value, or the constants we use for a jump or call instruction, which indicate where we're jumping to or what where the function we're calling is. And these are all going to be in little endian as 8 bytes. So, and I believe when we finished up last time, we went through, well, let's look at an example. So here's a function. And first, I need to make this valid y86. If you remember, y86 doesn't have this instruction. And this instruction is not going to have the same name if it did exist. So you can write some equivalent y86 assembly that actually uses instructions that exist to work around not having an add constant instruction. Okay, so now we have some y86 assembly. Let's look at what it takes to convert that to our encoded form. So the bunch of bytes that we're going to put in our executable and actually run. So I'm going to go instruction by instruction. I'm just going to take a row from the table. So if we look back at our table here, I'm going to say this is an IRMove queue. So I'm going to take this row, and I have a fill in the blank for RB and for V. And I'm just going to note that what values I have there. The fill in the blank for RB is RAX. The fill in the blank for this value is 1. And I know I'm going to have that in little endian eventually, so I've written out as a sequence of little endian bytes in the order they'll appear in memory. And I need to look up, well, what register is RAX in that table we saw earlier? It turns out it's 0. Go to that table, so we'll end up with a 0 there. And this is going to tell us what our encoding is. So we write this out as a bunch of bytes. We're going to write out that it's the byte 0x30 followed by 0xf0 followed by 0x10 followed by 0x00 and so on. Just copying from that table. So questions about that procedure? Okay, so we repeat that for each instruction. So I have my add. Yeah.
So why is
The question, is it always little endian? Yes, the YAD6 instruction set has decided that all constants are always 8 bytes and little endian. Okay, so then we go into our next instruction, and we look up in that row, we see that there's a 6, there's a space for the op, which remember is one of those second tables we have to look at. So it's whatever entry in that table there exists for add, and then we have 2 spaces for registers, RDI and RAX. So we look all those up in those tables I showed you earlier. So we look up and find out that add corresponds to 0, RAX still corresponds to 0, and RDI corresponds to 7. Assuming I didn't mess up this slide. And so we find out that after we write all the bytes of this first instruction, we're gonna have 0x60 and 0x70 as our next bytes. And we just go on, we look up ret. Ret is 90, so on the table, so that's just going to be 1 byte with a constant value. And we can just write that all out as a bunch of bytes, and this is our contents of memory written in hexadecimal. As just bytes, there's no endianness here because I'm just listing each byte one by one. From lowest address to highest address. And I've highlighted where the instructions start, but of course in memory we don't have that, they're just a bunch of bytes. If we want to figure out where the instructions start, we're going to need to later on look at this first byte and figure out which row of the table is it, and then use that to figure out where does the next instruction start. So questions about this procedure? So, as most of the examples, let's go through another example. So here I have a recursive piece of code. So double until negative, which has a jump greater than equal. So the first part is as before, we look up the add instruction on our table. We find out it's the opq row. We have a fill in the blank for add and the 2 registers. And this will turn out that add is number operation number 0. And RAX is register 0, so we find out that that is all zeros, 60000, that's the encoding of that instruction, it's 2 bytes. Then we have to encode this jump greater than equal. And to encode that, we're going to need to take this label and make it into a constant, that's the address the label corresponds to. And if you remember when we talked about linking, for a typical assembly, this would actually be multiple steps. We're just going to do it all at once. But typically, we'd have like the placeholder, and then we'd fill in the placeholder later. Here, we're just going to do it all at once. And I'm saying, in this example, that it's an address hex 123. So hex 123, we need to write out that as that's our constant that appears in the jump greater than equal instruction. So we're going to have that in little endian. So the first byte, the byte with the lowest address is going to be 23. The next byte is going to be 01 and so on. The last byte, which is the most significant byte, is going to be all zeros of our constant. So we write out, so you have our constant, and we know that this is a 7 is the let row for jump, and 5 is what we get if we look up greater than equal in that table of possible condition code values. And then I have my encoding of this address as a little endian constant. And we can just write that out as a bunch of bytes. So this turns out to translate into 0x60, 0x00, 0x75, 0x23, 0x10, 0x00, and so on is what the contents of memory will be for these instructions. Okay, so questions about this? Yes. Why 10? Because this whole thing here is going to be the constant 0x123, which we could also write as 0x00001 2 3 in little endian. So for little endian, we take the least significant byte of that, and that's the thing at the lowest address. So the least significant byte is going to be 2 hex digits, so it's going to be this 2 3, which goes there. Then we take the next least significant byte, and that's the next lowest address, and that's another 2 hex digits, so we take this 0 1. Okay. Yes, I didn't notice I had written that wrong. Yeah, so right, yeah, 0 1, so on. Catch. Just paying attention to what I was writing. Okay, so other questions or errors on the work I was doing? Okay. So the other thing you might want to do is go in the other direction. So here, I have some Y86 machine code, and I want to find out what the assembly looks like. So what's a good first step to take here? Just giving you a bunch of machine code. This is in hexadecimal, even though there's no A's and F's. As a sequence of bytes from lowest address to highest address. How do I actually translate that back to assembly? That's the first thing I want to do. I have the table here because we'll need to refer to it. Yes?
Look at the first byte.
Look at the first byte. Okay, so we have our first byte here, and what do I look for?
What operation it corresponds to on the table.
Okay, so we look, say, the first byte is a 2-0, which could be which row of the table? Can't be this one that starts with a 0, this one starts with a 1, this one starts with a 2. So it's going to be that row, the third row of our table, starts with a 2-0. So we know that this is our first instruction is an R move Q or a C move of some sort. Okay. And what I would usually do when dealing with this is I would look at this first row, and there's two basic options. So one thing you could do is you could say, okay, it's a C move. Let's see there's a CC fill in the blank. What value is that here? And I say, oh, 2-0, that's a 0. And look up what that means. Usually what I would do first is I would say, okay, it's an R move Q, and that's 2 bytes. So the next instruction starts 1, 2 bytes later here. And I would look up that in the table. And I'd identify, okay, we have an instruction that starts here, we have an instruction that starts here. I look up the row containing 6 in the table, and I find out that's another 2 bytes. So I say we have 1, 2 bytes, gets us to there. And I keep doing that to find out where all the instructions start. So after this 6-1 is the beginning of another opQ instruction, that's another 2 bytes. So we have 1, 2, so this next instruction starts with a 7. We look at the 7 row of the table, that's going to be 9 bytes. Remember, it starts with 0. So I skip 9 bytes ahead. So 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Counting those bytes, and this is the beginning of the next instruction at this 2 here. And I keep doing that and find the beginning of every single instruction. That's usually what I would do first. You can go in some other ways. And usually you'll probably notice that something weird's going on if you get off by one at some point. Like you'll find a lot of knops or something like halts or something like that. So once I do that, I just figure out where all the instructions start, and then I just look at each one corresponding row of the table. And the procedure for each row is that I just say, okay, I have 2, 0, 1, 0. And I know that's the two row here. So there's a 0 for the CC, there's a 0 for RA, so there's a 1 for RA and a 0 for RB, and I just look each of those up in my table. So I say I have an R move Q, and there's a 0 for CC, so that's the always, so it's not conditional. So it's R move Q and not C move something. I have 1 as a register, I looked it up in my table, I found that that's RCX. And I have 0 as a register, I looked it up in my table, I found that that's RAX. And that's how I get that instruction. Do the same thing for the next instructions, and hopefully I wrote this right. And just doing the lookup of those tables. So any questions so far? So this is just, I look for where the blanks are, what they're filled in with, and so on. Then I have my conditional jump instruction. And I say, okay, 2 as a condition code, that's L for JL. And I have this address, and I know that that's the little number, little endian number, hex 84. I don't know exactly what address that corresponds to, especially since I haven't labeled where addresses are and we need to do a bunch of counting. So I'll just write it out as just a constant. And maybe later on I fix that up into a label so we're doing, you know, wanted to figure out what was going on. Then I have, right. Then I have a missing R move Q instruction. That's what I forgot. Q. And then I do the same thing. So I say I have an R move Q from register 1 to register 2. I know it's an R move Q because I look up 0 as the condition codes, and I find out that it's, okay, that's the instruction I'm missing. Sorry. So then I have, so I'm missing an instruction in this, which we can tell because I know I have, this is an R move Q, it's a 2, followed by another R move Q, and I only wrote one down on this slide. So this is an RR move Q here that I'm missing. Yeah?
Is GCC 8 bytes or 9 bytes?
So the question is GCC, what's, oh, the jump instruction, how many bytes is it? It's, it go, ends at byte 8, so that starts with 0, so it's 9 bytes.
Okay, then why are the addresses are 7 bytes?
The addresses aren't 7 bytes. Remember that this whole thing here, even though it's 2 boxes, is the first byte?
No, in the actual code, there are like 7 times 2 zeros.
So this is the first byte of the address, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, the eighth. Yes. Okay, other questions? So hopefully this procedure is usually pretty straightforward. So it's different than your IBCM in that, you know, the instructions are variable length, which means you have to go in order when you begin. That's pretty straightforward encoding process. You just have to look up things in tables over and over again. Yes?
If you want to do a return, for example, would it be invalid if you said like 9-1?
The question is, what happens if I put an instruction, you know, if I choose some variation where I decide to change one of these constants to something else. And so in real instruction sets, on modern processors, typically they say that if you do something which is not the one of the valid encodings, that we're gonna detect that. This is what modern processors usually do, is that they detect that and it's gonna cause the instruction will not do something the same as the normal instruction. It will do something akin to crashing. Something we'll talk about later when we talk about exceptions. This hasn't always been true historically, so some processors are just going to say that if you use an instruction that's not in my instruction set, who knows what I'll do? And when you're implementing a processor, that's the strategy we're going to take, is that we're not going to care what you do for instructions that aren't on this table. Instructions that look similar, have the same first four bits as instructions on this table, but otherwise are malformed. We're not going to care what you do in that case. But in a real processor, often they want to be able to like make 9-1 do something in the future, so they'll make it do something now that breaks programs, so programs don't inadvertently start using it, and then they try to release a new processor and want to add the new instruction with that number and doesn't work. Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's our Y86 encoding. And now that we know about an instruction set example, let's go to building processors to implement that. And we're going to start by looking at implementing a single cycle processor. And we'll talk about cycles in a bit. So first we need to talk about circuits. And I'm going to show lots of pictures of circuits, and I have to describe, like, what am I showing pictures of? So first let's talk about wires. So for this class, wires are things which can hold a bit. Typically in hardware, this will be represented using voltage. You could imagine other strategies. And we're gonna say that, you know, we can have a bunch of wires that hold multiple bits collectively. And what wires do is we have a value that propagates down the wire with some small delay. So we set one end of a wire to a bit, and the other end is gonna have the same value after some small delay, which is usually pretty, you know, not worth talking about as far as performance. And usually, we aren't dealing with single bits in our processor, like our registers are 64 bits. So we're going to use a bit of shorthand on pictures, is that rather than drawing out, you know, for a 5-bit value, 5 wires like this, I'm going to draw them as a bundle of wires. And rather than writing out the bits that go on each end of the wire, I'm going to write out the value when we interpret that as a number collectively. So I'm going to say, oh, it's 26, so we have 26 on this bundle of wires. So questions so far? I'm just choosing an arbitrary direction for the bits to go. Yes?
For the bundle, you have to draw 5 wires.
The question is, do I have to draw 5 times? So it turns out that drawing like all these wires collectively is going to be really messy if I do that. So I'm going to take a shortcut and draw a single line. Okay. And usually, just to keep things uncluttered, I'm not going to distinguish how many wires are actually represented by that single line. I'm just gonna like say call like act as if it's a wire, even though it's a bunch of wires, and the number might vary depending on whether it's like 32 or 64 or 5 or 2 bits. I'm just gonna draw one wire. Sometimes when if I wanted to be explicit about it, you might see something like this, where I draw a dash over it and label it with 5 to indicate it's 5 wires. But usually I won't do that just to save clutter, because it turns out we're going to have to draw pictures with tons of wires. And even labeling them all that way is going to be would be pretty cluttered. So questions on wires. Okay, so these are going to be, you know, what we use to send values between two components of our circuits we're going to use to build processors. We obviously need some other components. And we talked, when we talked about bitwise operators, about one of the basic components, which was gates. And gates are these components which we can think of as they have some wires as inputs, so we connect some values to them, and we get an output. And they do this kind of instantaneously. It's not actually instantaneous. Just like a wire, there's going to be some propagation time from when we have a zero here to when this output is correct. But basically, once we set their inputs, their output is going to be set to the correct value, and that's how they work. And you know, that's going to take some time, but it's not a very large amount of time. Okay. And these gates are part of a general category of circuits we might call combinatorial circuits. So rather than just doing these gates, we learn that we can do lots of things with bitwise operations. So we can build bundles of these gates together in all sorts of funny ways. And we can think of these as just being able to compute pretty much any function if we use enough of them. And in this class, we're not going to be concerned with how do I add two values together with gates. We're just going to say, yeah, there's a way of doing that. Someone's going to build that for us and give us, here's a bundle of gates that add values together. It has some wires as input and some wires as output. And that's what we're going to be concerned about. So we're going to have this sort of general notion that we're just going to have a box we label logic. And we know that it takes in some input and produces a function of that output, you know, with some very small delay. That once we set those have those wires holding a value as its input, its output sometime very shortly thereafter is going to hold the appropriate output, hopefully very shortly thereafter. Okay. And if, as we change the input, the output's going to change with some small delay. So these are always computing, just like gates are going to always be computing. These bundles of logic are always computing the function of their input. They're updating as their input updates. And they're producing some function. We can encode pretty much any function as far as we're concerned in this class. Anyone will care about as a bunch of gates. Something to note about this is that the inputs might not be the same width as the outputs. For example, a possible function we could have is like is even, you know, or is multiple of 3. Those are valid functions, and obviously we have a smaller output than input. We could have a larger one. It's just any sort of function we can represent mathematically, we're going to assume we can build a circuit which does it in this gate-like fashion, that we give us some inputs a short time after we get the computation as an output. Okay. So questions about these bundles of logic? Okay. So let's talk about building some simple circuits. So let's start with attempt at a counter. So I have an add one circuit. So someone's going to build that for me. It just takes a number and gives me the one plus that number with wraparound, presumably. Okay. And let's say this wire is 3 bits, and so what I want to happen is that I'm going to start with all zeros on the wire to begin with, let's say. Let's say that's what's, you know, I somehow set the wires all to 0 at the beginning, time 0, and then some time passes, and I expect to get 1, then 2, then 3, and it's a bundle of wires, so they're going to, I'm just putting out the binary value that's there. Okay. So that's what would seem like this would do, but there's a problem. And to think about this problem, let's think about what happens on these wires physically. That we talked about wires representing, you know, 0 or 1, but that's not what we can physically do. Physically, we're typically going to have the higher voltage, and they have to move from one voltage to the other, and the physically that can't happen instantaneously. Another issue is that when two different wires in a bundle are changing between 0 and 1, they might not do it at precisely the same time, just because physically that's really hard to do. So there's going to be some desynchronization. So if we look at this transition period here, we have this period here where we have another value. We have, you know, briefly we have 0, 1, 1, and we have, and what's going to happen is, are we going to add 0, 1, 1? You know, and what, another question is, what does our gate do when we have a value which is halfway between 0 and 1? And the answer for all these questions is not great stuff. That as long as we leave the input stable, we'll get a good answer. But in the cases where we have these transient states, weird things are going to happen. And because our transient states are sort of dependent on each other, we're going to not stabilize. So if we just had a constant input that changed once, but we kept the input the same, that would be fine. But the problem is that what's going to happen here is not just that we're going to have this sort of transition here, is that it's going to go around on this wire and cause another set of weird transitions again, where the adder tries to look at our 0, 1, 1 and add 1 to it for a very brief period of time, and then tries to look at 0, 1, 0 and add 1 to it, and that's going to make this end up not being stable. Especially since probably this picture is unrealistic with how much time things are stable in between. Because our adder probably is working all the time, it's always changing the values as it's computing things, so it's going to be much worse than this. So, question?
I don't understand what's the second and third line. What are they?
So the question is, what are these lines? So these are like the measurements of our three wires. So the idea is that this is, you know, wire 2, 2, 1, 0, and up here is the voltage for 1, and down here is the voltage for 0. And the same thing on this one, voltage for 1, voltage for 0, voltage for 1, voltage for 0. And physically, when the wire changes from having a 1 on it to a 0 on it, the voltage needs to change, and it doesn't do so instantaneously because that's not how physics works. And it doesn't do so perfectly in sync because our adder is not built, going to be built so that happens. That's not going to be a thing we can physically do. So we're going to have these weird transition periods, and the adder is going to act on those and produce more weird transition periods, and the circuit will not stabilize. And it's probably worse than this because the adder probably doesn't take a convenient amount of time between time 1 and 2. It's probably changing all the time trying to increment the number. Okay, so other questions here? So, given that happens, you know, what can we do about that? So, our issue is that the logic's performing calculations all the time, which means that we never really give it a chance to just get a stable answer and stick with it. That instead, you know, while its input is changing, it keeps doing calculations and doesn't have a chance to like just stop and say, this is the next number, we're there, before we move on. So we need something to actually store values and say, this is the number we have for this time, and keep that value so we can move on to the next time and know what value we're on. So we need extra elements to store values. Which we'll talk about very soon. So here's our corrected counter circuit where I've added this thing I labeled count, which is a register. And this will cause our expected behavior. So what the register is going to do is that it's going to store a value to make sure that we hold the same value on this wire so the input to the add doesn't change while we want it to do its calculation. And we are going to, at times that we choose, have this register read in the new value and change its output, but we're only going to do that once the output is stable. So we're never going to try to read during this halfway point and send that to the adder. We're always going to be sending a stable value to the adder and letting it finish computing on that stable value. So yes, the inputs to the adder are going to change, and there's going to be some sort of crazy values coming out. But before we read into this register, we're going to wait for it to have a single input for a long time, so it produces a single output, and that's the only outputs we're going to use. And there's going to be something called a clock signal to decide when do we do those updates. So we're going to periodically say, it's been long enough. I know the adder is not transitioning between values anymore. We're ready to read a new value, and our clock signal is going to tell us when we've made that decision. And when we read a new value, we're going to take that stable value from the adder and avoid intermediate updates. So let's look at what that might look like. So we have a register, and this is sort of a different picture of what the register is doing. So here, I've represented the outputs where I've used just different colors, intensities to represent different values, and the inputs work the same way. I have these dashed regions in the inputs to represent where the input might be changing. Maybe because our adder is still computing values, it's still dealing with the input changing from before, things are still propagating, but that's going to be okay. And what the register does is that we have this clock signal, which is this sort of sawtooth change in voltage. It's, as we saw, it's not going to be quite so sharp. But we have this signal which has these distinct rises. And the register is going to look for these rises in that signal. And whenever that happens, it's going to read the hopefully stable value on its input and start outputting that. So as long as we make sure the register has a stable value whenever there's that rising edge of the clock, we're not going to have any confusion about these transient values, these in-between values. And this lets us take multiple steps. So we just move on to the next value whenever we have one of these rising edges for our counter, where our counter is computing 2 from 1. And when the clock signal rises, we decide to move on, no longer computing 2 from 1, to compute 3 from 2, and so on. Okay. So questions on what these registers do? So circuitry that works this way is going to be our basic building blocks for processors, that we're going to have a bunch of things which change state on these rising edges of the clock. And the pattern is going to be that we compute something before the rising edge and use it for our next step after the rising edge. In the case of our counter, our next step was counting the next number. In the case of our processor, our initial one, the next step is going to be running the next instruction. So we're going to have a bunch of things that hold state, some of which are going to be registers, other of which are going to be more complicated than registers in our Y86 processor that we're going to build. So let's talk about the things our textbook has chosen to implement the Y86 instruction set as our state elements. So some of them are registers. So we're going to use a register to store the program counter, to store the address of the current instruction. So we can think of this as just like our counter circuit. During executing one instruction, we're going to compute what's the address of the next instruction. It's going to be one of the things we do. And only at that rising edge of the clock will we actually move on to executing that next instruction and therefore changing what our program counter is outputting. But while we're running an instruction, it's outputting the address of the instruction we're running now. We also have a register for our condition codes, CF and SF. So sometimes we'll compute a new value for them, sometimes we won't. And something to note about registers is that we still have to input a value, but we can always input the same value that they're outputting. And that's how we'll deal with that. Okay. So those are our registers. So then we have this thing I labeled an instruction memory. And this is where we're going to retrieve our instructions from. So this is going to take in the address of an instruction I want to read and output the contents of the instruction. And this is not, in fact, going to use a clock. We have a register file. So a register file is so called because it's probably internally going to be built by taking a bunch of registers and putting them together in some way. The way we'll think about it is that it lets us read registers by specifying which register we want to read, or write registers by specifying which register we want to write. And conveniently, in our textbook's design, we have chosen that the way we specify which register we want is the same way it's specified in the machine code, so we just take the value we get out of the instruction memory and send it to the register file without any interpretation. We also have a data memory, and this is where we're going to access memory for instructions like RM move Q, MR move Q, that read and write from memory as part of their calculation. So these are the components that store state in our processor that have information. So let's first talk about the memories, which are the most unlike sort of our traditional registers component, and how they work. Start with the instruction memory. So the instruction memory is going to be a combinatorial memory. This is the design our textbook has chosen. It's not the only way it could have worked, but the one our textbook has chosen is a combinatorial memory. So it has an input where we put in a memory address. And after we put in the memory address, sometime later, without any sort of clock signal or anything, it outputs the value at that. So it works like gates, that we set the input, and with some delay, we get the output, which is the function of that input. The function in this case is the value in memory at that address. So there's no clock signal involved in reading from our instruction memory. So a concern you might have is, wait, some of our instructions are 1 byte, and some of them are 10 byte. You don't have any way of dealing with that here. What do you do? And the answer is that we always read 10 bytes. Instruction memory reads 10 bytes no matter what. If we're dealing with a 1 byte instruction, we're going to read 10 bytes and not use 9 of them. And this is actually simpler because now we don't need to have special logic to figure out how much to read. Okay, so this is our instruction memory, which is read only. So we also have a data memory. So the data memory has two parts, basically. So one part is that you can read from the data memory the same way we read from the instruction memory. You put an address on this wire I've labeled address, and you get out the data in the same time, you know, with some small delay. There's no clock signal involved in that. But the data memory also supports writing. So one thing we need is we need to decide which of those two things we're doing. And the way we do that is that we're going to have a read and write enable signal. So there's going to be a wire saying, am I reading now or am I writing now? And that's going to determine which operation happens. So one complaint you might have is, well, there's a read enable signal. What if I'm not reading? What's going to happen to my output wires? And the answer is, well, something needs to be on them. In our simulation, it's going to happen to be all zeros. But something's going to be on that wire because we can't have we have to have a voltage of some sort on those physical wires. So there's going to be a value, but if read enable isn't true, that value is not going to be useful. So what happens if write enable is true? And this is going to be different. So if write enable is true, we're going to have an address being input and a value being input. And the memory is going to read that value at the rising edge of the clock signal, just like a register would, and copy it into the specified memory location. The value is not going to change until that rising edge. It's going to remain the same in memory, meaning that, for example, if I'm writing with the data memory to a memory address, and it happens to be the same address I'm reading from with the instruction memory is going to always read the old value because it's reading before that rising edge. Yeah?
So
message message.
Oh, okay. So a good question is, like, is this clock global or not? So you could build processors which have different clock signals for different parts. For our processor, we're going to have one clock signal for everything. And everything is going to happen at these rising edges of the clock. Both of these things might not be true in a real, more complicated processor. We're just keeping things simple by saying one clock signal, rising edge is when things happen. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
So just to confirm, data memory does require a clock signal?
So the question is, to confirm the data memory requires a clock signal? Yes, for writing, we will require a clock signal. For reading, it doesn't. And this is going to be a common theme when we move on to our register file. It's going to work the same way. Writing is going to use a clock signal. Reading will not. Yes?
Is it possible to read and write from the same address?
Question, is it possible to read and write from the same address? We deliberately don't specify this. Don't do it. Whether you can set read enable and write enable the true at the same time. Just don't do it. Yeah? Question is, if you're only reading, do I need to specify an input to write? So in hardware, there's going to be a wire going into this physical component, and that wire is going to have a value on it. It's not going to be used, but you can't, like, there's no equivalent of null for a wire. So there's going to be a value there that hopefully won't be used. And in our hardware description language, you will have to specify a value, but it won't be used. So let's move on to our register file. So our register file is going to work very similarly to our memories, except instead of having an address, we're going to have a register number, which is going to be like 0 for REX, 1 for RCX, and so on, according to just that table we showed you earlier. But we have some differences. So one difference is that we have instructions where we need to read two registers. So it's not like our instruction memory where we read one thing. We need to read two things at the same time for like even some of our simplest instructions like add. So we have two what are called read ports. And for both of them, we input a register number and the corresponding output value is set with a short delay to the value of that register. And there's two of these, so I have highlighted one pair. There's going to be another one, which works the same way. Our textbook calls these A and B for the register that we're going to use, register file we're going to use for our processor. So we also have write ports, which work the same as our writing, is that we have an address to write, naming a register number to write, so 0 for REX, RCX, and the value to put in that register, a 64-bit value, and at the rising edge of the clock, we actually update the register, which means if you're reading from REX and you're inputting REX as the register number to write, it's not going to change until that rising edge. You'll still read the old value until the rising edge of the clock happens. And we again actually have two of these. Our textbook calls these E and M. And again, they're in pairs. The reason our textbook calls these E and M is E is for arithmetic, so-called execute. M is for memory values. Our textbook splits things up that way. We're not planning on having you implement the instructions that write two registers at once. There's one instruction which does that, which is pop. And that's why our textbook has two of these write ports, is because the pop instruction needs both of them. If you didn't have the, if you don't implement the pop instruction, you only need one. So, questions about register files so far? So one thing you might notice that I didn't draw here is there's no write enable signal. And the register file that our textbook has designed works differently than our data memory does for that. So for the data memory, we have this separate signal indicating whether we're writing or not. Here, we don't. Instead, we've decided that register number 15 is going to work differently. That if we try to write to register number 15, it's going to be ignored. So that's how we do write enable. Our write disable is we specify register number 15. If we specify anything else, it's writing. We can also read from register number 15, in which case we always read a 0. Which is just for sake of, not because we might need that, but because, you know, we have to put some values out on the wire. The textbook has, we've chosen to define that it's going to be 0. Okay, so questions? Yes. Okay, so those are our state components. So these are the things we're going to build our processor from. And initially, we're going to design our processor so that we do one instruction per clock cycle. So each of these rising edges, when we write values, we're going to end up switching from one instruction to the next. And as part of that, we're going to write any values written by the current instruction with that rising edge of the clock. And then after the rising edge, we'll start executing the next instruction, like reading from its instruction memory and so on. So that's going to be what we're going to do initially with these components. And later on, we'll have a different design which uses the same components but is going to be faster and a harder implementation. Okay, so questions so far? Okay, so we have these state components. Let's move on to some logic components we'll need. So one thing we'll talk about a bunch is ALUs. ALU stands for Arithmetic Logic Unit. And this is going to be the component of our processor that does the bulk of the calculation. And typically, the way we imagine these work is that someone builds this for us. It takes in two inputs, in our case of our processor, because all our operations have two operands, and some wires to select which operation we do. Is it an add, is it a subtract, is it an XOR, or whatever else our processor implements and produces an output, which is that operation. So most obviously, this corresponds to our OPQ instruction. We saw we had add, subtract, XOR, AND. We're also going to use this for some other operations later on, like computing addresses for a move. Okay. So questions? So now that we've introduced our components, let's build a simple processor. So I'm going to build a processor not for the Y86 instruction set, but for a super simple instruction set. This instruction set has one instruction. That instruction is add. Because we only have one instruction, I'm not even going to have an opcode. I'm not going to have that first byte of the instruction. I'm just going to have two register numbers on my instruction, the two register numbers to add. So I have one byte instructions, no opcodes, none of that first byte telling us what instruction we're doing. I'm going to build this processor. Okay, so let's go through the steps I need. So first, I have a program counter that holds the address of the instruction I'm executing. And if we think about executing this instruction by hand, the first thing I need to figure out is what's the instruction? So I need to read the machine code for it. So our first step is going to be to take the value I have in the program counter, send it to my instruction memory, and we know in the same clock cycle, just with a short delay, we're going to get out the actual register numbers on the instruction memory's output. And I want to send those into the register file because I know I need to read those registers to find the values I need to add. So I definitely need to read each of those registers. So I have this box I've labeled split. And what that's going to do is that's going to take my bundle of 8 wires and sort of split it off into two bundles of four wires. So that's a trivial piece of logic that I just drawn a box to represent. And that's going to get me my 2 4-bit register numbers. One is the first 4 bits of the byte, the other is the second 4 bits. I'm going to pass them to my register file, to my 2 register number to read inputs, which I've labeled here as source A and source B. So source A, I specify that register number, and then I get the value of the register with that number, which I've represented as the registers as an array R. That's the notation that you'll commonly see for that. So R source A is the register with number source A, the value of that register. So I'm going to get those 2 values out. And once I get them out, I want to add them. So I have this box of logic which doesn't add. We're going to do that with an ALU. So I just have an ALU hardwired to do an add operation. Okay, then what do I want to do with that value? So I've produced, added 2 RXX and RYY together. What's the next step for my simple add instruction? Yeah.
Write back.
We need to write the value back to a register. Which register?
RYY.
RYY. So to do that, I need to set up so that at the rising edge of the clock, I'm inputting to the register file the register number RYY in the register number to write input, which I've labeled destination E. And the value that we added together, which I've labeled next R of destination E, I've labeled it next to indicate that it's not the current value, it's not the value we'd be reading here, it's the value that will exist after the rising edge of the clock, when the write happens. Okay, so that's me wiring those 2 things up. So now I have what looks like a processor. So let's say I have a program here, and let's think about what happens. So we execute this first instruction here at address 0. Our PC is 0, so we're outputting 0 here. And we have 0 and 2 as our 2 register numbers. So we input to our register file at, based on our instruction memory output, we get 0 for source A, 2 for source B. We get the 2 values in the registers, in this case 10 and 20. We add them together. We're going to get 40. And this is all after, before our rising edge. So here is what we're showing. And then at this rising edge, we're going to store the 40 in the register file. Because that's how the register file works. We look for that rising edge of the clock, we store the 40, and then we should move on to the next instruction. So how's that going to work? Is there something I'm missing? Yeah. No. Okay. Yes. So we need to compute the next address. And your proposal is, well, the ALU is how we add things, so we should use the ALU to do that. And that's a great idea, except the ALU that we showed you can only add 2 values at once. So, but you're right, we need to compute the next address, because with things now, what's gonna happen is our PC is a register. We're going to have our rising edge of the clock, and at this rising edge, it's going to say, what's my input? And on this picture, the answer is, you don't have one, and who knows what happens, you know? We need an input so we know what the PC does. So we need to give something, and you want it to be adding 1, which it seems like we do with an ALU. So our solution, it's going to be that we're going to have more hardware. So we're going to have a separate +1 circuit from our ALU. And this is what we're going to do for our processor design in general, is that we're going to say, Now, we always need to do this address computation for the next PC. We're going to have separate circuitry for doing that from the normal computations, just so we can do both at the same time. So this makes sense. And here it's plus one because our instructions are one byte. Okay. And after we do that, now the PC increments by one, and we can keep executing the next instructions. Again, and this is going to be with our clock signal. So we'll have another one of these clock signals, and at this rising edge, RDX will get updated to 60. And we'll start, and we'll also have at this rising edge is when our PC gets updated to one or two at the next one. Questions on what I've done here? Okay. So let's start with, let's do another simple processor. Here's my other trivial ISA, another one instruction set. And this has one instruction, which is jump unconditional to label. Okay, and because we only have one instruction, I'm not going to have that first byte. I'm just going to have an 8-byte address. So let's build this processor. We need the PC and the instruction memory. I'm not even going to draw the register file because we can't use registers in assembly, so we don't need it. And the way we build this CPU is that we're going to connect our PC back to our memory. Okay, so that seems okay, so that makes sense. Okay, so that seems simple. Now let's do something a bit more complicated, and let me fix my slides because. I inadvertently hit some slides. So now we need to make a decision. So we're going to extend, you know, here's our jump CPU. That seems simple enough. And I want a CPU that doesn't just do one instruction, but does two instructions. So I'm going to want to do jump. And let's say the next simplest instruction to jump, which is nop. So first of all, what's my encoding going to look like? For this, what should my encoding be like? So what's the machine code if I want to add NOP to this? Can I use the same setup here of just a 8-byte little endian address? If I'm adding, having jump plus NOP. So what was YAD6's encoding for this? How did it distinguish between the two? So if we go back here, let's take what YAD6 did. For NOP, we had this 1-0 at the beginning. For jump, we had a 7. So we're going to just duplicate that to keep things similar. And we're going to say for jump plus NOP, we're going to have a different, we're going to have our encoding is going to be that jump is going to be 7, 7, 0, and then the address. And NOP is going to be 1-0, just like YAD6. Okay. And that means we need to make a decision, because what we want to do here is not this, but we want to, sometimes, we want to take our add one, and sometimes we want to take that. And we can't have two values going into our PC register. So you need a way to decide between the two options. So what's that way going to be? And the answer is that we're going to use a new component we need known as a mux. So we're going to need to make a choice, the mux, and obviously I had more slides for this, which I think we've recovered. Nope, okay. But, and let's just, okay, let's just, go to an appropriate place. So we need a mux here. So what a mux is going to look like is that we're going to have one or more inputs and one output. And we're going to draw it like this. So this is our mux. And the way the mux works is that we input a select value, and that's going to tell us which input do we choose. So for example, I'm going to be able to choose a select value of 0 to input to take this first value as output, or maybe a select value of 1 to take this second value. I meant to do different color. A select value of 1 to take a different output. So that's a two-input mux. So we have two inputs and two outputs, which are both these wires, these bundles of bits. And this is going to let me choose whether here I have my add one or I have my alternative of the value from the instruction map from the PC. And I need to make that choice, and the way I'm going to make that choice is that I'm going to have a split off part of this value. And that's going to be how I choose which of these operations I do. And I have here a mux where I have two inputs. So the idea here is that I'm choosing either one of two things. We can generalize this and say, rather than having two inputs, I can have more than two. So I can have four inputs, A, B, C, D, and we just assign each of these numbers, like so, and we have another selector bit for that. Yes. So I don't have the slide I intended to show, but I can show a picture with HCL we'll talk about later of what this ends up looking like. So what we have here is that with this MUX tool, now I take my instruction and I split it off into two parts. So I have one part, which I have labeled here as I code, which is going to be my either 70 for jump or my 10 for NOP. And based on that, I choose between PC plus one or the address we got from the jump. And I send that to my PC input, so at the end of the next cycle, that's what we get. Does that make sense? Okay. And finally, after. Right, now I have the slides I intended to have. Okay. And so this gives us our clearer version of that. Okay, so I only wasted like 5 minutes. So this is our MUX again. So typically you can build this from gates as our textbook describes. We won't have you do that. But you know, they're basically big gates with a truth table that looks like that. Big in the sense they have more than one input, more than two inputs. And this is our NOP jump CPU. Okay, so questions on this CPU? On how we use MUXes here? And this is going to be the general pattern. Every time we need to make a decision like, do I want to do PC plus one or the address from the instruction memory, we're going to add a MUX. So this is how we're going to do all our decisions in our processor. It's the if-then of the processor, is this MUX. And one thing you can think about is that anytime you want to have two instructions that do different things, there's a decision there, you're going to add a MUX. So with that in mind, let's talk about, and we have different inputs chosen by the values. Let's talk about a hypothetical issue, which is our NOP add CPU. Okay, so let's say instead of NOP and jump, so I showed you NOP and jump here. We have NOP and jump. We have one MUX to decide what to do between them because there's only one decision, which is what's the next instruction to run. And I'm moving on to NOP and add, and we have more decisions to make. So which of these cases do we need MUXes? We might be more than one of them. So the question you should be asking is, for which of these do we want to do different things depending on which instruction we're talking about? So you saw how we do an add, and you saw how we do a NOP. A NOP is just PC plus one. An add, we have to actually read from the register file, add them together, and put them back in the register file. So I'll give you a minute. Okay, so who thinks we need a MUX for case A? No one. Who thinks we definitely don't need a MUX for case A? A couple people, okay. How about for case B? Who thinks we don't need a MUX? Who thinks we don't? Okay, someone wants to defend we need a MUX? No. So this is subtle. So let's go through each of these this slowly. So for this, for NOP, we don't read registers. So that's a reason we might want to mux. We might want to mux to decide between not reading a register, between supplying register number 15 to do nothing or not. But it's not strictly necessary, so because it's but okay to read plus ignore. So we don't strictly need one because we can always read a register and ignore the register being read. Because it's harmless to read extra registers. Here, NOP, we compute PC plus one, and for add, when we have both of these instructions together, it's going to be PC plus two because we have that first byte saying this is an add. To distinguish it from a NOP, so we actually do need a mux there to decide whether it's plus one or plus two. Before the register number to writes, this is the other case where we definitely super need a mux, because otherwise we might modify a register number based on what register number is in memory after the NOP instruction. And for a NOP, we never want to change registers, so we need to supply register number 15. For NOP, and the only way we can guarantee we have a 15 is by having a mux to choose 15 in that case. For the value, we don't need it. Technically, we could have one, but as long as we supply register number 15 to write, it's not going to matter what value we supply. You could imagine going the other way around and supplying the value of the register you just read to avoid the problem. And before the instruction memory's address input, we don't need that because we're always reading from the PC. Okay. And sorry for messing up my slides in the middle there. I'll have this corrected. Post them.